Hello, and welcome to another episode of Beyond Busy, the show where we talk productivity, work-life balance, and how different people define happiness and success. All the big questions for work and life. My name is Graham Alcott. I'm your host for the show. And on this episode, I'm talking to a very special person, NK Chowdhury. He's the founder of Jaipur Rugs, the first Indian guest that I've had on the show, and honestly, one of the most inspiring leaders I've ever come across. So really, really excited to have him on the show, more of which in a moment. So I hope you're okay. I hope you're well. It's feels like we're lockdown again is brewing. If you're listening to this in the north of England and lots of other places, it's already here. And I can kind of feel there's a bit of an anxiety kind of driving people's thought processes at the moment as people think about strapping in for what could be a very long, cold, stressful winter on lots of different fronts. So hope you're okay and surviving that sort of imminent sense of doom that seems to be going around at the moment. If we do end up on lockdown for winter, then here's a lovely segue. Then there are some spaces still available for my 6 weeks to Ninja online evening course. So it starts in November. If you go to grahamalcott.com, you'll see a pop-up for that. And also just, there you go, a little pop-up on my screen right now. grahamalcott.com/6 weeks will get you directly to that page as well. If you want to sign up for that, it's going to be a deliberately quite small little group. So there's going to be no more than 30 people. And I'm going to be walking people through all the stuff from my book, How to Be a Productivity Ninja. And also spending a lot of time with you guys on implementing it all as well. So we'll have a WhatsApp group for accountability through the weeks and making sure that people actually do the stuff that they are resolving to do as part of the program. So if you're interested in that, 6 weeks in Ninja, just go to grahamalcott.com and you'll find out more there. So let's get into this week's episode. So NK Chowdhury, I met back in 2012. I was on a study program called Journeys for Change, touring around India and talking to leaders and particularly social entrepreneurs. NK Chowdhury is the founder of Jaipur Rugs, huge exporter of very high-end, beautiful luxury rugs. And his founder story is absolutely fascinating. We talk about it a bit during the episode. Basically, he kind of defied his parents and lots of other people in his life and worked across the caste system. So in India, there are various different castes of people and there are very set expectations for what those people do, who they mix with and so on. And the people who are deemed to be at the bottom of society used to be referred to, and I think in some places still are, as the untouchables. And Mr. Chowdhury made a very deliberate decision to work with those people to help them to install weaving looms where they were so that they didn't have to travel and be exploited going to, you know, factories working 18-hour days, and they could basically work flexibly. And we toured around a few of the facilities of Jaipur Rugs. It's we toured around a few different villages, and it's just absolutely remarkable what he has built and his eloquence and just presence as a leader are just phenomenal. It's fair to say that English is not his first language, so this is a slightly difficult listen. You might find it just takes a few minutes to just kind of adjust to some of the pronunciations and to really kind of hook into this. But honestly, I would say just listen to it twice because he is so inspiring. And I'm going to be doing some writing over the next few months, particularly around heart in business and, you know, kindness in leadership and a few topics around that. And it's fair to say Mr. Chowdhury is very high up my list of people to feature as a case study as part of this. So super inspiring. We reconnected a few months ago and I said, I'd love you to come on and do the podcast. And he said, yes. So I'm just delighted and thrilled to have him on. So let's get into it. Here's my conversation with Mr. NK Chowdhury.
I'm here with NK Chowdhury. You're based in India, in Jaipur. So first thing to say is it's early afternoon here, late afternoon there. So good afternoon, Mr. Chowdhury.
Good afternoon.
It's just such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And just before we press record there, we were talking about how I was talking about the government lockdown and guidelines about home working and not commuting to offices. And you're saying that you actually live on in the same compound as where you work as well. So that makes two of us. So let's just start by, do you want to just describe where you live and what your setup is around life and work?
I live in the same campus of my office. And so it is much easier for me to take my lunch out at the home. And because so many people are not coming to the office, so I spend my 50-60% of time at the home, and I only come to the office when I need. And in last four months, I think it was totally a different journey, very, very comfortable.
Yeah.
And very joyful.
Yeah. And so, and what's changed through the current COVID situation, and how is that, like what's happening with COVID in India right now?
Things are getting worse and worse day by day after the opening of the lockdown, and government is trying very, very hard. But still, it is very, very difficult to prevent the COVID.
Yeah, and I suppose also in India, you have some very densely populated cities as well, right? So, you know, Delhi and Mumbai, and I spent a little bit of time in your part of the world too, in Rajasthan and Jaipur and places. But yeah, you have a lot of people in small spaces, which must also make it quite difficult to contain something like this.
Yes. You are right.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your journey then with Jaipur Rugs. I remember coming to visit you in, I think it was back in 2012, and just coming away from that visit, just so inspired by you and the work that you'd done. And what's quite interesting, we were just talking there about how your house is in the same compound as the offices. And that's kind of how you started, right? So you getting into the business of hand-woven rugs.
Right.
The first looms that you had were in your house. So you've always been someone who's worked from home and sort of combined work and home in the same location, right?
Right. So should I share my journey?
Yeah.
After passing my graduation exam, I started my career selling shoes from a little shop which my father started. I also got a permanent job in a nationalized bank. I declined the offer as I wanted to do something of my own, and there was very little room to grow at the shop on which I was working. So then I tried to find out my passion, who am I, what would I like to do, and I found that I'm a people person and I love nature. So at that time, I realized that there were very less weavers in India, but the export demand of carpets was very good. So I thought I must start this business because I will be able to go to different villages and I will be able to work the people who is rejected by the society, by their own family members. So 42 years ago, I took a loan of $200 from my father, bought two looms and one old cycle, and I started this carpet business. After I started this business, I was in so much love with weaving and the weavers that I used to take my lunch with the weavers. And I was spending all my time with the viewers. But the first challenge which came at the time is from my own family members. In those days, rug weavers belong to the untouchable class and were not given the same social standing as others. So given the strong class system in India, interaction was not possible. So I realized that time that how my family members, my neighbors, friends say them they are the untouchable. How we can judge a person by the caste? And at that time, I realized the hypocrisy in the society. People are something else at their home. They are something else in the office. They are something else when they are alone. And then I was a contractor manufacturer for nine years and spread my business in and around my village. And after 9 years, I came to Jaipur to start my own export with my brother. I stayed for 3 years in Jaipur. But at that time, I realized the carpet have a huge demand. So to satisfy the demand, I went to Gujarat to a tribal area. The government of Gujarat was trying to develop that area because there was very huge unemployment. And on the very first day when I was there, the local people told me, if you go to this area, people can beat you, people can kill you. They are the tribal people and they are not very welcoming to the outsider.
So this is in Gujarat, right?
Yes, Gujarat. Yes, yes, yes.
And how far is that from Jaipur, just for people that don't know the geography of India, which I have to say, I don't know that well either. So
it is 800 kilometers from Jaipur.
800 kilometers. Okay.
So people told me that you should not work in this area because tribes are not very welcoming for the outsider. So I have got an English friend who lives in London. His name is Ayla Cooper. And he is known for writing the books about the painted walls of the Shekhawati. So whenever we have some problem, we try to get his advice. So I ask him about should I work in this with the tribal people or not. He suggested me that they are the most innocent people in India. The people, outside people, they exploited them very badly. So they don't trust them. So if you deal with them with love, compassion, and empathy, that will be your biggest loyal force. So after taking his advice, I went to that tribal area, stayed for 9 years, and where I have an opportunity to train 15,000 tribal men and women in the art of rug weaving. And within 3 years, they started treating me as their guide and their mentor. When I was going to the villages, their parents were waiting me standing outside their home. At that time, I have got 3 daughters. And in our society, if a woman have got first 3 daughters, then the people in the house think that there is something wrong. So my wife has always complaining me that family members are seeing me as the inferiority. Then I ask my friend, what is the solution of this problem? And my English friend Ayla Cooper replied me that in your society, you differentiate between the boys and girls. So boys get spoiled and girls don't progress so much. And you are very lucky that you got the first 3 daughters because women are more receptive and more efficient. So by taking his advice, me and my wife took them better than the boys and went them to study in America. And when they were going to study in America, I told them, I enjoyed weaving and I'm a weaver. So you are going to study in America as a daughter of the weaver. And never forget this. Because when you study, you should try to observe about the lifestyle and you must take a deep interest in the American lifestyle. So when you come back to India, you have a better understanding of the customer needs. And now you can see the impact of all my three daughters.
So your three daughters are now very instrumental in running Jaipur Rugs.
Yeah.
It'd be good to just give the listeners a little bit of the chronology. So in terms of dates and times of putting this story in perspective. So you started with looms in your house in the 1970s, is that right?
Yes, yes.
And then 1986 was when you started with your brother.
Right.
And then Jaipur Rugs in its current form was 1999, right?
Right.
And you were just saying before that you, in Gujarat, you trained 15,000 people in how to weave rugs.
Right.
So that's over how long a period of time? Because that's like a football stadium worth of people, right? So how long was that training process, and how long would someone typically spend learning how to weave?
I lived in Gujarat for 9 years, so I trained all these people in 9 years.
Okay.
But for a person who don't have the skill of carpet weaving, it takes 1 year.
Okay.
To be an efficient weaver.
And also, you were talking about your parents there. So you'd got three daughters, and it seems like there was some expectations that if you have three daughters and no sons, then something is somehow wrong, right? That's like a cultural idea in India. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
And so I'm just wondering how much that was also linked to like your parents' expectations of what your working life would be. Because from what you were saying before, working with weavers, working with people who are, in the terms of the caste system, the untouchables, as you mentioned before, it's like that's not seen as a thing that you should like aspire to as your job, right? So you were taking quite a big risk by making that your career, and by working with the people that you worked with, both in terms of the caste system and then also in terms of this tribal group in Rajasthan, right?
Right.
So what was your motivation for, why didn't you just want to be a banker or a civil servant or like one of those so-called more respectable professions?
Because in the initial stage, I tried very hard to introspect who am I, what is my passion. So I wanted to live a life where I could enjoy whatever I do. And I follow my passion, I follow my intuition, and I can listen myself. So my criteria for the success is that to do what I like, what I enjoy, and where I can lose myself.
Yeah.
And I think that is why the business model of Jaipur Rug became so famous, so unique. And generally, so many people ask me that, Mr. Chaudhary, how you thought about your business model? How you design your business model? And I always tell them that I never thought about business model. Still, I don't know what it means by business model. Everything came very organically, very naturally. I always enjoyed what I did.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the numbers in the business. So a couple of things that I read, and you can tell me, because a couple of things I read were a few years old as well. So I don't know whether these numbers have changed a little bit, but I saw written somewhere that you've got over 7,000 looms and 700 locations. Is that right?
Yes.
I mean, logistically, how do you keep track of that? Like, do you have like a huge database with all of those different looms and what's happening on each one? And what's the logistics of something like that?
In each area, we have got the different branches which supervise a special area. And we have got the branch managers, quality supervisors. So they go to the looms and they are the local people. And everything is provided at the weaver home. And we have got a very good ERP system. So we have got all the real-time information in our ERP system. And as I told you that we have got very good relationship with our weavers.
Mm.
The whole weaver community is like our family member.
So how many weavers right now do you have working on rugs?
We have connected with the 40,000 weavers.
Wow.
And there are so many weavers who only work on the very special time. They work at their field, and when they have time, then they come to for the weaving. So it is a part-time job for them.
I think one of the things that really struck me, so I came and visited your offices, and then we went out and did a tour into one of the villages where we saw some of the weavers actually at work. And I think a couple of things that really struck me. One was the general culture that you'd managed to create, where each of those weavers felt connected to something much bigger. And I want to come back and talk about that a little bit later as well. And I suppose the other thing that it really, really struck me was that this is, in lots of these villages, a way to create employment, particularly for female members of the household who otherwise have childcare responsibilities and lots of other things going on.
Right.
Where it would be really difficult for them to entertain doing a more regular job, or it's quite difficult to find jobs in a lot of these more remote places as well.
Right.
And so, like, do you see sort of part of your mission as about empowerment of people who are very poor, and also empowerment of people who are women? Like, is that something that was, like you say, it was organic, but that must have been part of what was driving you to expand in the way that you did and create the business model in the way that you did?
I think that if you love yourself, if you trust yourself, it start overflowing and reaches to the others. So I think my love to myself. So whenever I go to the villages, the women in the villages, they can read my face very well. So I think slowly, 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 the things goes to the next home, to the next village. And one day it converted into a family of the 40,000 artisan.
So you have this family of 40,000 artisans all across India, or all across northern India? Like, how far are they spread?
It is all across northern India.
Yeah.
From Jaipur, the maximum distance is 1,200 kilometers.
Okay. And then the rugs themselves, so you've sold rugs into 60 different countries.
Yes.
And what's really interesting about this is that you have this business model which connects some of the poorest people in the world to some of the most wealthy people in the world. Because right. Your rugs they're handmade. It takes a long time to make each rug. In fact, it'd be good to just hear in a minute, you could just give us an example of how long one rug would take and you know, what would be involved in making that rug. But, like, you know, this is a luxury purchase that someone's making. So you're literally connecting the poorest people in the world with the richest people in the world, which I suppose there might not be many companies or many brands that are doing that just within one brand, without a supply chain, kind of without hundreds of other retailers and other people involved along the way.
Right.
Should we just talk about what does it take to make one rug? So just maybe give us some of the numbers, some of the how long it takes. Just give us a bit of a flavor of what's involved in creating a Jaipur rug.
As you know that C.K. Plath, who is the number one management guru, also did a case study on Jaipur rug business model.
This is the one in the Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah. We'll put a link to that book in the show notes as well, so people can check that out.
Right. He said that Jaipur rug supply chain is the most unique by connecting the poorest of the poorest with the richest of the richest, by enhancing the capability at the grassroots. So when I started this business, I have a firm belief that there are two ends of this business. One is the end consumer, and one is the weaver. And if I complete this circle, it makes the totality, it makes the whole. So I started this business with this vision. And Jaipur is only a platform to connecting the end consumer with the weavers. And as far as the your question, how many time takes a carpet? Generally, it takes a 8x10 carpet. It also depends upon the quality, number of the nodes, but still it takes 3 months to 6 months.
So 3 months to 6 months, that is that one person weaving full time or they're doing that part time?
Not one person. On a 8 feet wide carpet, there are about generally three women.
Okay.
Working on one carpet. As I told you that it is a part time job for them.
Mm.
So when they are free, they weave on the carpet.
And I also read somewhere that an average carpet that you would produce would have almost 1 million knots. Is that right?
Yes. 1 million knots in a big carpet.
Yeah.
You are right.
Wow. So it's just, yeah. And I've seen very many of these rugs up close as well. And they are just absolutely beautiful. So we'll maybe just put some links as well, just so that if you're listening to this, you can just get a sense of what Jaipur Rugs are creating here. I love this phrase that you had, which is, we don't sell carpets, we sell a family's blessing. So can you just tell us a bit more about what does that mean? We don't sell carpets, we sell a family's blessing.
Because I see Jaipur Rug as a platform connecting the end consumer with the weavers. So our tagline is that we don't sell the carpet, we sell the family blessing, we sell the stories, we sell the experiences, and our carpet is free. Because I tell you one thing, that Raj Sisodia wrote a book, it published last year. The book is all about healing organization. So he writes in his book about Jaipur Rug, that how Jaipur Rug business model is healing the society, and by healing the society, it is also healing the customer. Because due to Jaipur Rug business model, the dignity of the weavers went many times, and their income became 2-3 times more what they are earning before.
Mm.
And they have a better life, and now they are so open that it transformed their life. They are getting the dignity, they are getting the money, and it is a very big change in their life. And from last 10 years, I'm seeing thousands of people each year come to see them, to spend a lot of time with them. And I have seen thousands of people coming throughout the world. They say, this is the best experience in our life. This is the best experience in our 1 month visit in India. And we are getting also so many emails, communications from our end consumer, that when they hear the story of the carpet they bought, how this carpet has transformed their life, they feel enlightened, they feel joyful.
And it feels like storytelling is a very important component in the business, right? So on the one hand, yeah, you can look at it as, you know, you're producing these carpets and then you're selling these carpets. But as you're saying there before, it's like actually what you're really selling is this sense of healing and this connection between the weavers themselves and the end consumers themselves. And you've used storytelling a lot within Jaipur Rugs as a business. So one of the things that you did quite early on, I think, was starting to bring a lot of the first weavers that you had into the head office to kind of see, to tell them the story that actually what you're working on here is not just one carpet, but like it's part of this much bigger company and this much bigger picture.
Right.
So just tell us about how you went about doing that, because again, you know, this is not, there's a lot of companies who would work in the same industry as you, and they would either just use factory manufacturing, or a lot of the jobs would be quite exploitative. They'd be on very low wages, and they'd be taking those people into factories to work long hours in factories. Whereas your approach is very different, because it's very person-centric. Like, people are weaving rugs in their own homes. And then I guess the problem with that can be that it becomes quite almost like a remote experience. So yes, I'm working on this carpet and then it gets sent away, but I don't get to see that bigger picture. So why did you think that was an important thing early on? And what were the sort of challenges in making that happen? Did you find that some of the weavers were not happy about being asked to go to the head office, or was it a difficult sell? Because it would obviously have just been a very different kind of thing to ask people to do than what people are maybe used to doing.
I think when I started this business, I was a very innocent person, and all the time I was talking like a child, and I was enjoying the human connections at the grassroots.
You're enjoying the what, sorry?
So when I was enjoying human connections.
The human connections, okay, yeah.
Yes, with my viewers. So when some customer was coming, some outsider people were coming, I was talking about my relationship with them. And slowly, I realized that people who come globally, they realize that the story, what I'm telling to them, is very authentic and driven by the innocency. And 10 years before, we ask all our customers, people coming throughout the world, that you can go to meet the viewers. And when they went to see the viewers, they saw the more better things, what we were telling to our customers, to our people. So I think the authenticity and the innocency in business is the main part of the storytelling.
I think there's so many things in business that are quite inauthentic, right? So people tell lots of stories about how environmentally friendly they're going to be, or about the diversity of their organization, or about what the promise of their brand is, and all these kind of things. And often they can be quite, quite fake and quite inauthentic. But I think what's interesting is that I think you recognize quite early on that you just have this very authentic story to tell. And actually that's a big part of the brand, isn't it? It's like selling that to people who have the money to buy luxury goods is like a really big part of the success of Jaipur Rugs, right?
I think that because this story have the authenticity, and I always talk about business is all about connecting the human beings by the heart.
Mm.
So I can see a very big future that end consumer, interior designers, architect, and Indian designer and our viewers, they are co-creating together. Because when we connect with the people, then the creativity of everybody in the system comes together and creates something new. And as the success of our project Manchaha, the designs created by the viewers got 7 global awards in last 7 years.
So this is a thing where what you've started doing is saying to the weavers, okay, rather than just weaving the carpet, like, do you have ideas yourselves about the designs? And there was one I saw in a video which was to do with, was it called Disharmony or something? And the idea was that there was some weavers working on this carpet and then they weren't getting along. And then you could see like this, almost like the story of them being in disagreement with each other on one end of the carpet, where lots of the bits of weaving were kind of not linking up properly. And then later on the carpet, you can see that it's all much more harmonious and you kind of see that journey of them from like disharmony to harmony, and like that was their design.
Yes.
To create that. So again, you know, using that storytelling so that the weavers are actually involved in the design. Was that something that just came from like conversations that you were having with them, or was that your vision? Like how did that come about when you first started doing that?
That there were three men, and when they started their home designs, they were not very along with each other, but slowly they started communicating with each other, and ultimately they were working together, and design were very symmetric. So when we saw the carpet first, that we realized this is not going to sell. This is the biggest mistake which I had never seen before. But when we started telling the story to our customer, that it became so famous and also won the award. And now inspired this design, we made so many designs from the inspiration, and those are the best selling designs.
Wow, that's cool. And you also have a loom in your head office, right? So when people, either weavers or foreign visitors or employees, when they first come into the office, everybody like ties a knot in this loom so that like over a long period of time, everybody creates this one carpet, right? So how long has that been going on for?
This is from last 6 years.
Okay.
My daughter Kavita, she's a designer and she's very creative. So she do so many things like that.
And how long will it take to finish?
It takes years.
And it's like part of the story that it will never finish. Like it's almost nicer if it's like a constantly developing thing, right? Like it would feel like sad to get to the end almost.
Yes, it will continue. And I want to tell you a very interesting story that one day the textile minister of India, central textile minister, who came to see our business model, and we took her to the loom and she started weaving on the loom.
So you've had government dignitaries, you've probably had people from very many countries and all kinds of different people all working on this same carpet.
Yes.
That's cool. Let's talk a little bit more about you and some of the things that drive you. When we spoke a little while ago, you were saying to me that you feel like you have three enemies.
Yes.
And you were talking about desires that are unsatisfied.
Yes.
Your ego.
Yes.
And unconsciousness.
Yes.
And it's something that I wrote down and was really thinking a lot about. And so I'd love to just explore that a bit more. So these are, you were talking at the beginning about how early on in your career, you realized that it was important for you to do a lot of work on yourself and reflection on yourself. So these three enemies, is this like a thing that you've discovered more recently, or was this something that you discovered this at the start of your career? Like, I'm really interested to know how you came across this philosophy or idea.
When I started this business 42 years before, the purpose of this business is to know myself.
Mm.
In India, the people on the journey of self-realization go to Himalayas, go to ashram, go to temple.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided that I will not go to any ashram. I will start business, and due to my karmas, due to my actions, I will know who am I. So I was reading a lot of books, thinking so much. And 8 years before, I realized that there is something wrong. I'm doing the same thing again and again. And I realized that I am in the autopilot mode, and I am driven by my habits. I'm the slave of my habits. And then I started to introspect that how I came out of my fixed mindset, my habits. And then I realized that I've got these three enemies, And I also realized that I was driven by unconsciousness. So slowly, slowly, early in the morning, I started introspecting that what I did yesterday, why I did it. And I found that I was a very reactive person. I have got so much negativity. I was driven by unconsciousness, habits. And slowly, slowly, by the practice, I started, I was able to see myself, my actions, my own thinking. And I found that slowly, slowly, I can see the things. I was able to see the things which I was not able to see before. And I can see a huge change in my personal life and in my business decisions. And I want to tell you one thing, one example, that one day I was sitting in my office and was thinking that I'm not getting the people who are aligned to the values of Jaipur Ag, who are aligned to the purpose of the Jaipur Ag. And an intuition came to my mind and I changed the name of my HR department. And the new name was Search for Divine Soul.
The Search for Divine Soul.
Yes, yes.
Wow. So the HR department is still called The Search for Divine Soul.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I called out my HR people and tell them that from today, we are not going to take the interview of their experience, of their clothes, of their age. Now, we must find a person with the passion who is on the higher journey of the truth. We must only take the people who are the inner journey. And thank God, within the last 3 years, we have got so many people who is in the journey of enlightenment, and their work is so excellent. And I'm sure they are creating a great future, not only for the Jaipur Ag, but for the customer, for our viewers, and for the whole country.
So you're looking for people when you hire who have this journey towards enlightenment, which I'm guessing part of the way that you would find that is to look for certain values. But I'm just curious, how do you do that in a job interview, like in a recruitment process?
Yes.
How do you find people that you feel are more enlightened or on that journey?
I want to give you one example that so many people came, and the smart people, they read on our website and they read about Jaipur Ag. And they say that we want to work with the society and we want to do the noble cause and we want to help the others. And some spiritual and religious people comes and they say that we want to meditate the other people. We want to increase in the consciousness of the other people. So the one thing which I ask them, that tell me about your inner journey. I know you have a great thinking about doing the good for the society, but how are you doing good for yourself? And then I can understand the person is on the journey of truth or not.
And what's your experience in terms of how people find that? So do you think there are just people who are much more self-reflective than other people, or are there particular practical tools or practices like meditation or yoga or something like that that you think generally lead people more towards that kind of self-reflective thinking?
I think that biggest thing is that they are very self-reflective. They think about themselves. And I think it gives them chance to see what they are doing. So they can always avoid themselves from doing the wrong things for the wrong reasons. And all these people, they don't do the things which don't add the values. And they are very highly focused. And they always believe in the deep work, and that makes a difference.
And when you yourself spend a lot of time on your own journey to enlightenment, and you talked before about spending a lot of time in the mornings thinking about yourself and thinking about some of the enemies within yourself and so on. Like, what does that look like? Do you meditate? Do you just sit quietly? Do you journal? Like, what does that look like when you're spending that time? Or is it just, it's in the moments where you're walking or eating or whatever? Like, do you have a particular sort of practice yourself around those kind of things?
Yes. What I realized in last eight years, that if I want to transform myself, all the spiritual practices is like the stairs, but that is not the destination. The destination only comes from the understanding about the self. So I try to develop my understanding that what I'm doing, why I'm doing it. And I want to give an example at the stage where I am today. I realize that we create a false identity into the business, into the society, into the family, that I'm this. And I realize for myself, it means nothing. You only create the false identity when you don't know yourself. If you know yourself, you need not to have the outside recognition. Start understanding yourself and you have a deeper understanding, then you need not to get the praise or any outside recognition. It comes from inside.
Yeah. Can we talk really quickly about those three enemies that you were telling me about before? So desires, ego, and unconsciousness.
Yes. Because when I realized these three enemies within me, I found that what I'm doing, I want money, I want fame, and I'm in a hurry to get the money and the fame. And it is creating me, it is putting me in the autopilot mode. And the second thing about the ego, the false image of myself, I'm this, I'm that, I'm a good person, I have this. So I'm creating my identity in different ways. And that is your ego. And the other thing is the consciousness, that when I start something, at that time, I was so blind and unconscious that at that time, I don't know why I'm doing it. I'm rushing without knowing why. I'm rushing without knowing the destination. So I think when I started taming these three enemies within me, it makes a lot of difference.
Yeah. How do you detach ego how do you separate ego from identity? Because before there, you were talking about the ego of I'm helping people, I'm compassionate, I'm doing good. And these are often in a Western viewpoint, things that we think about as being detached from ego, because we tend to think of ego in the West as being about selfishness, right? And self-centeredness. So how do you kind of recognize which bits of your identity and your sort of definition of you is ego versus how much of it is the real you?
I think when I started realizing about myself, I found that my love to myself is the most important thing. And up to now, I was searching myself outside the outer world. So what I think that the more you come closer to yourself, then you can see the relationship in the outside world, the connection in the outside world actually don't exist. The only connection which we can make is with ourselves. And I also think that when we starting knowing ourselves, the love, gratitudes start within us. And one day start overflowing. And when it start overflowing, it reaches to the other. So it is a natural phenomena. It is a very organic and very scientific thing.
And I think there's probably lots of people listening to this who would find it quite hard to have that level of self-compassion. I think, you know, most people that I work with have some kind of, very, very common or favorite ways of criticizing themselves or beating themselves up or being critical or negative thinking, you know, towards yourself. Are there some ways that you can suggest for managers, leaders to help to instill some of these qualities in other people too? So, you know, what can you do in the culture of organizations to help people to be more in touch with who they are?
I think it is a great, great question that I have seen the managers and people at the top. I found that the most of the people is driven by the inferiority complex. And when we come in the inferiority complex, we compare ourselves with the other person. And inferiority complex creates fear. So we want more and more and more. And we see ourselves in the eyes of the others, which never can satisfy.
And this is now the classic thing of the Instagram, you know, comparing all of your own worst negative thoughts of yourself with everybody's idealized versions that you see online of themselves, right? So it's like even worse.
Because at the time we are driven by the fear, and due to the fear, we try to collect so many things. We want to create the crowd, and so negativity, frustration, depressions, so many things starts from the fear.
I'd love you to say more about that element of fear, and maybe a bit more about how people can address that in themselves, overcome that in themselves, and just think about it some more. I feel like it's something that is quite neglected often.
Yes. Yes.
Just generally.
You are very right that last week I have 2-3 sessions with so many very good colleges in India. And when I talked about this inferiority complex, the students become very serious and they start sending me the message that it is changing their life before they don't know. I told them that we live in a world which is not true. There are so many things we don't exist, but still we believe and we try to achieve them. And in my whole life, I worked with the educated people, and always those people put me upside down. Instead of developing the understanding, they became very manipulative. They became very cunning. I always say that knowledge is power, but knowledge gained without practice develop ego. Sometimes the practitioners have the skills without having the knowledge. So I think due to the education, due to so many books, they think that I am knowledgeable. And to knowing about the light and to knowing the light makes a big difference. So the whole world is confused. They are knowing about the light and they think this is the real world. It is only a knowledge, but knowing the light is the real thing. So I found when a person is driven by the inferiority complex, is totally away from the understanding of his work. In the business, I have found most of the people still in our business, they are totally away. They don't understand the people in our business. They don't understand the processes. They don't understand the product. And without the understanding, they are making some big decisions. So actually, it is destroying their life and the business and the society.
So having that knowledge and then not following that up with practice, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
That there's a lot of people who they develop knowledge either about themselves or about other things and then don't apply that knowledge into practice.
Right. So I want to tell you one thing, that what I learned in my life, that the people who is driven by the mind, he only uses his mind. The mind always creates the problem which don't exist. The mind creates a small problem bigger. And the mind creates a big problem so complicated it never can be solved. The solution only comes from the heart. So if you are not driven by the heart, and the heart is, if the heart is not going to the hand, it means all the time our mind are working, because our heart and hands, we have closed them. So we are creating, when we try to solve the problem through the mind, actually we are complicating the problems.
So again, I suppose the obvious question for people listening to this is, I'm sure lots of people will be listening to this thinking, yes, I want to follow my heart more. I want to think about how I can solve problems with the heart rather than the mind, and definitely relating to this idea that often the mind can complicate things. And I'm sure that feels quite alien to lots of people. So are there some ways that you think people can help themselves to be more heart-based in their thinking, in their decisions, in their actions?
I think that it is a matter of self-awareness. So how we can work on our self-awareness? Because due to unconsciousness, we have a huge blindness around us. So I think self-awareness is the answer. I want to give you one example. Then I have seen the people who is meditating from very long time. And when I interact with them, I found that when they meditate, they have a different meaning. And when they came out of, after meditation, they have a different meaning. Meditation means you must work as the meditation. So your work became your meditation. So I think self-awareness is the answer.
So you're saying meditation doesn't help because it becomes almost like a job in itself? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that meditation is like the stair. It will help you to reach at your destination. But meditation with understanding, that makes a difference. That when we meditate, how after I came out of the meditation, how awareness I have in my everything I do in the daytime. So I think that should be mixed with the meditation.
Okay, so when you come out of the meditation, then you... Because sometimes when I've done meditation and yoga, sometimes you find that then you're just, traveling in a car or just making a cup of tea or something, and you feel more aware of those really simple things more after you've recently done something like meditation than you would just if you just got up and started your day and whatever. So do you think that is that part of it is recognizing not just meditation, but then also trying to be more mindful in each and every moment rather than just saying, I'll be mindful during these moments of meditation, but then I'll just go on and live the rest of my life and be busy.
Perfect. I think this is perfect. That awareness, alertness, before I start anything, how alert I am, how aware I am, that makes the difference. And I think the practicing the awareness, the practicing the alertness, it really make a big difference, whatever we do. That is the real meaning of meditation.
That's fascinating. And I just think there's so much wisdom. I remember spending some time with you when I came to visit, and we were talking about a similar theme to what you were talking about towards the beginning of this conversation, actually, around business being a very useful tool for self-actualization and, you know, using business as the place to learn about yourself rather than sitting in a yoga ashram or you know, traveling the Himalayas or some of the other examples that you mentioned. And I remember thinking, I just think there's so much wisdom here. Obviously, you've had a very long, very successful career with Jaipur Rugs. I just wonder before we finish, because we're just about out of time, are there any particular kind of key philosophies that you have or key learnings from your career that we've not talked about so far that would just be a nice one to kind of end the episode with? And, you know, just in particular thinking about, I would love to just kind of hear a little bit more about how you make yourself successful and what does productivity mean to you in the work that you do as well.
Should I end by sharing a story? When I was in college, one day my business administration professor came to class and asked a roll number, and that was roll number was mine, and he asked me to stand. And he was a very strict professor, and I started thinking that why he asked me to stand, because I was a very disciplined student, and I thought that I have done no mischievousness. Why is he asking me to stand? And then he took out a test copy in his hand and showed to everyone in the class and told that, see the answer this boy has written. The question was, what is the definition of business? And what I replied is, business is next to love. It is the creator and preserver of civilization. And the professor said, this boy will become a unique businessman one day.
That leaves me with so many more questions about how, I just have to ask you before we finish then. So why do you think you had that kind of perspective at such a young age? Because this is when you're in college. This is before the business. Yeah, why did you have that kind of perspective at such a young age, do you think?
I think it is very, very, very organic. But what I remember in my young days or when I was a child, that I realized that I live in a family, I live in a society where the people are driven, as I told, by the greed and desires, and they were doing the wrong things for the wrong reasons and suffering very badly. So I can see it very clearly since my childhood. So I think then I took that, maybe I took the different path due to that learning.
That's cool. And I know you spent quite a bit of time yourself in the US and the UK, and very many other places around the world. There's often this sense of cultural difference between East and West. And I wonder if there's anything that you can tell us about how, from a more Eastern perspective, you view the West. And maybe just, we'll make this like the final question, but is there anything that you would really recommend that people in the West do differently? Things that perhaps you don't understand or feel like we're getting wrong here in the West. I'd love to just finish with that as a question. What do you really question when you come to the UK and the US, and things that you think that perhaps we should be doing differently here?
I think the Western world, there are so many innovation, so many things happened in the Western world, but I think they missed one thing, which is themselves. What I feel that that love is the only criteria for the sustainability. So whatever we do, any innovation, anything which we do, love should be the criteria, and that will make the difference.
Yeah, maybe that's just a perfect place to finish. I'm immediately thinking about all the different ways in which that could manifest itself, but I think that's probably just a perfect place to finish up. We'll obviously put a link to Jaipur Rugs in the show notes here at getbeyondbusy.com. So if you want to check out a bit more about some of the other things that Jaipur Rugs is doing, some of that initiative around storytelling, we'll put some photos of some of the actual rugs on there as well. Mr. Chowdhury, it's just been a huge pleasure having you on this podcast. And is there anything that you want to particularly draw people's attention to as we finish, either ways to connect with you or just other things that you think people should check out, and anything else that you want to let us know about before we finish?
My last thing is that just be yourself.
Perfect. Knowing yourself and then being yourself, I think, is just a really strong message from this podcast. So thank you for being on Beyond Busy.
Thank you.
Wow. I hope you enjoyed that one. I honestly just don't have a lot to say after that, other than thanks to Mr. Chowdhury for his time. And I'm really looking forward to working with him again over the next few months, as I said. If you would like to find out more about the previous episodes, we have the show notes at getbeyondbusy.com. So getbeyondbusy.com. And this episode is sponsored by Think Productive. So if you're interested in productivity workshops and training for your business, then just go to thinkproductive.com and you'll find out more there. Quick reminder again that there are tickets for my 6 weeks to Ninja online course starting in November 2020. Come and be locked down with me in the evenings and boost your productivity, and we will help each other through this long winter. So grahamalcott.com/6weeks, and you can find out more there. I also did a big mail out last week. So I'm doing this weekly email list called Rev Up for the Week. And if you want to sign up for that, just go to grahamalcott.com, and on any of the pages there, there's a little sign up form. And Rev Up for the Week is my weekly email where the idea is I put a positive, thoughtful thing in your inbox every Sunday, ready for the week ahead. And I really just felt compelled to write last week's one about The Social Dilemma on Netflix, which I just watched. And do you know what was interesting is I had such a strong response of people emailing me back and telling me about how they dealt with social media, how they dealt with this addiction to devices and stuff that just seems to be getting worse. And the whole thing with The Social Dilemma is it feels very dystopian, but it also feels like a bit of a moment. It feels like, I don't know, there was a lot of stuff. I'd read Jaron Lanier's book and, you know, big fan of his work. And I had thought about a lot of the stuff that was in this documentary. And I actually wasn't going to watch it. It had been kind of recommended on my feed a couple of times on Netflix. And I'd sort of turned it down and thought, yeah, I don't need to watch that. But then when you do, just the way they put the argument across and the way they use this particular narrative device of actors pretending to be the algorithm of what to show you to sort of keep you hooked in, it really made me think, oh my God, there's something really serious here that if we're not careful is actually going to just destroy us all. And, you know, I mean, it was very difficult to write a rev up positive piece for my mailing list. I think I did a pretty good job of it, but yeah, it was a difficult one to make positive, that's for sure. And what was interesting was just how strong the response was of people just emailing me back. So if you did email me back, I'm still working through the replies, and I will reply to you, as I always do to people who reply to my mailing list emails. Just always, not always the next day after I've received it. Sometimes there's a little backlog. But yeah, so if you want to be part of that, we'll actually put that mailing list one up on the blog somewhere, maybe on my Medium or on grahamalcott.com somewhere, so you can have a read. But yeah, sign up to my Rev Up for the Week mailing list, grahamalcott.com, and you'll get the future ones. So that is it for this week. Thanks to Mark Stedman, my producer on the show, and Podient for hosting. And we'll be back next week with another episode. We're now a weekly podcast. So spread the word, like, subscribe, all that good stuff. I'll see you next week. Take care. Bye for now.